I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, health insurance, health care, and prescription drugs are getting more and more expensive. They're so costly now that millions of Americans no longer can afford them. This isn't just a problem reserved for the low income. It's become an issue hitting the middle class. The crisis is particularly acute in Texas, where we have the highest number of people without health insurance. The number of uninsured Texans remains at nearly 5 million, representing more than 16% of the total population, the largest percentage of any state, more than double the national average. What are the drivers of the rising cost of prescription drugs and health care? How is this impacting you and your family? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Throughout 2025, you relied on us for fair-minded journalism and thoughtful programming. Now, with federal funding for public media gone, your support is essential to keep TPR strong in the year ahead. Whether you make a one-time gift or become a sustaining supporter, you help ensure this service continues. Give online at tpr.org today.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. I'm sure you've seen it, you've noticed it, you've taken, you can't help ignore it, the rising cost of health care, health insurance, and prescription drugs. It's getting so bad that so many Texans can't afford it anymore. The price at the pharmacy counter is becoming impossible to manage. Even with insurance, deductibles, and copays, it can turn a routine refill into a major monthly bill. For people without coverage, the choice can be even starker. Some are having to ration medication, delay care, or go without it altogether. In Texas, where more people lack health insurance than in most other states, those pressures land harder, especially in rural areas and low-income communities, in places where pharmacy access is already limited. So what's driving these price increases for your medication? We're joined by Charles Miller. He's with the Texas 36. He is the health policy and director there. It is a nonpartisan public policy think tank in Austin. And Charles Miller, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here and always happy to talk about issues around healthcare and affordability.
Well, there's always a lot to talk about.
That's for sure.
And trying to make it make sense for people, because it's complicated really fast, gets wonky really fast. But I think one way to keep it real is to hear from our listeners. We do want to hear from them. Have you ever skipped a refill, cut those pills, chopped them up, delayed care, gone without medication because of the cost? Have you been surprised by the jump in a price, even with insurance? If you're in a rural area, have you had trouble finding a pharmacy that stocks what you need, had to drive long distances for a prescription? It's really important that we share these stories so that we can recognize that it's not just you. This is happening to a lot of people, particularly many folks who are now uninsured, and the ranks of the uninsured are growing. Charles Miller, who are the uninsured in Texas?
Well, thanks for asking. We've at Texas 2036 have done recently a multi-year study that we titled "Who Are the Uninsured?" So it's a very appropriate question. And what we were trying to find out was, why is it that there were so many people in Texas who were uninsured, even though when we were looking at the data, it seemed like so many of them were eligible for existing programs at relatively low cost? And what we found was that a large amount of the uninsured are not only those who are what we would call below the poverty line, which is a federally designated amount of money that varies based on your household size, but a lot of them are folks who simply were not aware of the availability of existing programs like Medicaid or the Affordable Care Act, or the affordability of those programs that are out there. And a big chunk of the uninsured in Texas, and somewhere around half of them, are in what we would call that middle income range. That's about twice the federal poverty line to about four times the federal poverty line. For a family of four, that can be between about $60,000 to around $120,000, and that's actually a big chunk of the uninsured in Texas. So demographically, it's not always necessarily who you think it is. And that was part of the big message that when we would go talk to legislators, we were really trying to make the message that it's not only the folks with the lowest incomes in the state, it's also hitting middle income folks as well. So wanted to talk about some of the reasons why we found these folks who are uninsured. And it really came down to a lot of people think that you can only get insurance if it is offered through your job. And that is not the case. There are options out there for people who are on their own. And we call this the individual market. And then there is also for people who qualify Medicaid coverage as well. But the individual market in Texas is really a surprisingly affordable option for many people. And we can talk about a little bit more the impact that some of the enhanced subsidies and what's going on in DC right now would have on that. But the message that I want to send out right now is if you are uninsured and you think that it might be the price might be too high, go check, go look. Contact a broker, get on healthcare.gov, find one of the online brokers like eHealth Insurance or Health Sherpa. Go look and see what it will cost for you, because what we have found is that even with the enhanced subsidies expiring, over 80% of current enrollees are probably still going to qualify for a free plan. So the message is go check, go look at it. The news out there is negative about prices getting worse, but there are still a lot of affordable options out there, and people just don't know about them.
So to the point about the healthcare subsidies expiring, we're looking at the House right now. They're poised to pass legislation today that would extend the Obamacare tax credits for 3 years. They had a discharge petition. They had a handful of Republicans cross over to support the Democratic side of the House in order to bring that over. And this is, you know, it's not going to pass the Senate as is, but this is fueling hope that it will bring about a bipartisan compromise with the Senate in order to at least get something done. Not a 3-year extension, maybe a 1-year extension, and then also has to land on the desk of President Trump, but he may bow to public pressure and sign it. But the point I really want to get to, even if these extensions are passed, it still puts a lot of Texans, they still don't have health insurance. You know, it's good for many people, but there's still so many people that are still going to be suffering even with these extensions.
So the enhanced subsidies and whether they are extended or not, that will impact a number of people. And the group of people who are actually going to be most impacted by that are those individuals who make more than four times the federal poverty level. So that family of four, that's about that $120,000 level. Those are the folks who, if the subsidies, the enhanced subsidies do expire, would lose all eligibility for any subsidy. And the subsidies are quite generous. They limit what you are expected to pay for insurance to a certain percentage of your overall income. And so they cover a lot of the difference between those expensive plans out there and what you make. So folks in that range could see their premiums, what they're expected to pay, really skyrocket by perhaps even as much as $10,000 a year. This is a huge impact for them. There are also impacts for folks at lower income levels, and those are still important for those individuals as well. But the most dramatic, the ones that have captured a lot of the attention, are for those folks at those higher income levels who would lose all eligibility for subsidies and not just a changed amount of those subsidies. And I think the point that you're talking about is there are also issues for people who do not have coverage here in Texas. And a lot of those people who don't have coverage, again, we want to say there will be affordable options out there for you, regardless of what happens with the debate in DC. If something is passed, it will become more affordable and you can get perhaps more generous coverage for the same cost or less expensive coverage at that same level of generosity. But we just want to emphasize, go take a look at what is out there. And if DC decides to add some additional subsidies to it, then you will benefit from that as well, most likely.
We're talking about healthcare and the rising cost of prescription drugs. And a medical debt continues to be a problem. About 40% of Americans have some substantial medical debt. So the health care system is sick. How do we have a healthy market for health care? And we're going to talk about that some more when we come back. You can call in, tell us about your situation, 833-877-8255. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, speaking with Charles Miller. He's the Health Policy Director for Texas 2036, a nonpartisan policy think tank in Austin, talking about the rising cost of healthcare. Healthcare in Texas isn't just getting more expensive, it's getting less competitive and less transparent, which probably why it's becoming more costly. Also, that's happening with prescription drugs. There's also a lack of competition in that area as well. So, Charles Miller, do you think lack of competition is part of the problem?
Absolutely. So we frequently talk about healthcare costs. And to be just a little bit pedantic for a moment, one of the issues that we like to talk about a lot is that it is not always necessarily the costs that are the problem, but the prices that are the problem. And prices are higher than they should be because there is a lack of functional competition in the market. Our healthcare markets are not healthy and they're not functioning the way that we should. And when we think about what are the core components of a healthy market, first of all, it's got to be informed. You have to have people who understand what it is that they're buying, what the price would be, what it would do. People need to have the right information in order to make informed decisions. As one of my favorite legislators like to say, though, if all you have is information and transparency, but you don't actually have choice, you only know how badly you're getting screwed might be the most nice way of saying it. He uses a different word. But you need to have choice in order to take advantage of that information. And that's where competition comes in. We need to make sure that there are enough choices of medical providers, of hospitals, of drug providers, of insurance plans at all levels of the healthcare ecosystem and delivery mechanism so that people have that choice. And that choice is what inspires the competition. We also have to make sure that there's an appropriate level of engagement, that there's an aligned set of incentives so that as patients and consumers, we are incentivized to select and purchase high-value care, and high-value means high quality and low price, but also that the care deliverers, the drug manufacturers, the health insurers, the hospitals, the providers are incentivized to deliver high quality care at a low price. And so we need to make sure that our market has all three of those components, that it's informed and that it is competitive and that it's engaged. So that's what our policy efforts have focused on to look at that.
I hear about the problem of this vertical integration of healthcare in America, that doctors work for hospitals, hospitals work for insurance companies work for hedge funds. And so there's an incentive for them to make money. And we see that in these wide-ranging price variations, depending on where you go for a drug or a procedure, things can vary by a factor of 10.
So part of this transparency revolution that has happened since we've started getting price transparency files being made public is we have seen the massive extent of price variation that goes on. And you hit the nail on the head. You can get the same procedure at the same quality, and within a given metro area, that procedure can vary by a factor of 10x. Depending on where you go, or sometimes depending on who your insurance carrier is, because the prices that are negotiated for these are just a little bit random. Some of this is the problem of vertical integration, as you said. And for listeners who might not be familiar with these terms, when we talk about integration or consolidation, we talk about it horizontally. And if you think of horizontal consolidation, that would be if an insurance company goes out and buys out another insurance company, or a hospital goes out and buys up another hospital. It's a like kind of consolidation. So now there's fewer of that kind of provider. That's harmful because there's fewer choices at that level of service provision. But there's also another kind of consolidation that is harmful, and that's this vertical consolidation that you were talking about. And this is where an insurance company might buy up a primary care practice, or a hospital might buy up a specialty group. And this vertical consolidation reduces your choice in other ways. And so if you have an insurance company that owns certain medical provider types, you might get steered or suggested to go towards those owned or affiliated providers by that insurance plan design. In Texas, if it is a state-regulated plan, we have actually passed a law that makes insurers have a fiduciary duty to the patient to make sure that if they are incentivizing people to go to a certain provider, that they're doing so for the best interest of the patient and not self-dealing. That's an important protection. It's a new law. It has yet to be seen if it'll work, but that is an important protection, and it's actually one of the leading concepts here nationally in order to help prevent some of that self-dealing.
A lot of people will go to the border, will go to Mexico, cross over Nuevo Progreso, places like that, in order to get their medication, their prescriptions filled. Why are those drugs so much cheaper just right across the border? And I've gone and I've done some stories on people who do this. I run into people who have traveled thousands of miles, you know, over 100 miles, you know, like from Louisiana, from Arkansas, all over. They come down to the border to buy their medication.
So why drug prices vary around the world is one of these really fascinating questions that happened. And some of these are legitimate. We don't always have necessarily the best quality control chain when we leave the American ecosystem. But that's not the whole story. It also has to do with the negotiations that occur within each country. And America is one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest country on earth. And the negotiations that occur between drug manufacturers and the ecosystem within this country mean that we end up paying more for access to drugs than many other countries do. Now, there have been efforts to try to remedy this or address this and suggest that the American payers would have a, say, most favored nation access from drug manufacturers, so that the prices that are charged to America and Americans would be the same as prices in other countries. That might benefit America. It might also have harmful impacts for consumers in other countries. And so depending on your perspective, that could be good or bad overall. But the reasons for why exactly those drug prices are cheaper in other countries is one of these complex kind of international geopolitical stories that doesn't have a very clean story. One of the interesting things that Texas has done recently is passed a law that would enable it to import drugs from Canada through an FDA approval process. Now, that law has not yet been implemented yet. State agencies have to build a framework. They have to work with the federal FDA in order to make that importation process happen. But it was recently authorized by US federal rule to enable this, and Texas has at least legally taken advantage of that to set up that framework. And that framework could allow Texas consumers to take advantage of some of these lower prices for drugs that we see in other countries. In this case, Canada was the one that the federal government approved and that the U.S. legislation took advantage of.
So, Charles, do you see going into Mexico to buy your pharmaceuticals, do you see that as a effective and safe coping strategy?
It's hard to say, assess safety for a country as a whole. Certainly there are any number of pharmacies in other countries that are producing safe, effective, and reliable drugs. But it is, I couldn't speak to every particular place where you would purchase your drug as to whether or not that is safe.
Well, what about the quality of the drugs, of the medication?
So generally speaking, if we're talking about drugs that have been manufactured by the big manufacturers, those drugs are identical. And I'll give an example here. We have seen some states actually take advantage of this. I believe it was Utah had put in place a plan for their state employees to be able to access drugs from certain Mexican pharmacies. And that plan seems to have worked for Utah. So without endorsing this wholeheartedly and saying, yes, absolutely, everyone go to Mexico and get your drugs, I think that it does show that that is an opportunity that can work for some. But it just does, you need to be cautious and make sure that where you are going is a trusted pharmacy that has a reliability for safety and efficacy.
What about these online pharmacies buying your drugs online?
Again, online is another mechanism, and we could talk about something like Amazon, which is going to be a completely FDA-regulated pharmacy. I believe their product is called PillPack. There are other pharmacies that offer products online. But also online, you can find opportunities to purchase drugs through maybe gray market channels from other countries that have perhaps more legal risk associated with them. And so the category of online, I think, is maybe a little bit too broad.
But Amazon, that should be legit.
Absolutely. And so there are any number of fully FDA-regulated pharmacies that allow you to purchase online, and then there will be mail delivery. And if that's an option that works for you, certainly recommend it and look around and try and find and make sure that the prescription drugs that you are most interested in have a price point that works for you.
So even the fact that we're talking about this and people are doing these things, they're considering these alternative ways, strategies to get their prescriptions. Is that a red flag that, our system is not working?
I think absolutely it is. And it points back to this problem that healthcare as a whole, and prescription drugs are a part of this, has become unaffordable and the growth in expenditure has become unsustainable. One of the big numbers that we point to is that employer-sponsored insurance for a family of four is now averaging, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, over $26,000 per year. And that's over a third of the median household income, which is just a huge amount of national wealth and income that is being spent on healthcare. And we see this not just at the large systems level numbers, we also see this at the personal level, where the majority of Texans have reported skipping care due to cost in the last year. And that's true not only of those without insurance, it's higher for those without insurance, but a majority of Texans with insurance coverage have reported skipping care due to cost. So not only are our premiums going up, but our cost sharing has increased as well. And by cost sharing, I mean increased deductibles, increased co-pays. These amounts have gone up as well, as a coping mechanism for dealing with the increased overall price. And what that means now is that people are being more exposed to these high prices, and people are coming up with all sorts of creative ways to try to get around that, which is, I think, as you note, a red flag that something needs to be done. We need to address the core problems in here that are leading to these high prices. With drugs in particular, I think there's two big categories of things that are leading to high prices. And one of them is actually kind of a good story. There's a bit of a nuance to it. And that is, we are getting all sorts of new, marvelous, wonder, miracle drugs that are being developed all the time. And in this country, when somebody develops a new drug, they get a patent, which is effectively a government-granted monopoly. And they get that patent for a period of years, And basically, they should go get as much money as they can and get very wealthy from that. And I would actually argue that that is a good thing, because we have so many drugs that come online all the time that simply did not exist 5, 10, 15 years ago.
It's like these weight loss drugs.
Exactly. These weight loss drugs are wonderful. The numbers that are coming out on this of their efficacy are incredible.
But obesity. Now they're coming out with pills for the, you know,
I got to take a break here. Injection, and now they're coming back with pills. You said we need to take a break?
Yeah, I got to take a break. And our phone lines are open. We do want to hear from our listeners. What steps are you taking, your coping strategy, when you see prescription drugs becoming unaffordable? Are you having problems paying for your insulin, blood pressure medication, asthma inhalers, mental health medications? How are you dealing with this? We want to hear from you. Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Charles Miller. He is the Health Policy Director for Texas 2036. It's a nonpartisan public policy think tank based in Austin. We've been talking about the rising cost of prescription drugs, what's happening with the cost of health care, lots of issues happening here with trying to keep Texans healthy. Having insurance is a big deal, and so many do not have it. Call in, tell us how you're coping with this, 833-877-8255-833-TPR-TALK. So let's go ahead and get Sandra on the air. Sandra's just called in. Sandra, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment today is we tend to make drugs our solution. And I think we can move towards other kinds of solutions like diet, exercise, sleep, good mental health. And when we make our focus, change our focus to the solution, it could also help drive drug prices down for those who absolutely need drugs as their solution.
All right, Sandra, appreciate that calling in. Thank you for that. Charles Miller, getting people to live a healthy lifestyle. Of course, you know, there's no substitution for that.
Absolutely. And
but you get sometimes a doctor got to help you on that too, you know. You got to check with the doctor before you get into a rigorous exercise routine.
A lot of times we talk about what we would call these non-clinical or non-medical factors of health. Sometimes they're called the social determinants of health. But so much of what makes us healthy is not actually health care or drugs. And as the caller notes, it is these other factors that are really quite very important. There have been a number of complaints over the years that perhaps medical training is not geared towards or designed preventive care, but I think it goes broader than that. I think it gets to what our overall system incentivizes and where the financial incentives are in the market that we have created for what we call healthcare. And this is the way that we pay for healthcare is on this general fee for service. And what that means is that if you get sick and you go to the doctor, they are able to bill or charge for a service, and then they get paid for that. There is not nearly as much money or incentive for keeping patients healthy. And to the caller's point about there being a large incentive and maybe going to pharmaceutical intervention too quickly, I would never say that this is the case for all things, but statistically, there may be some incentive set up to prescribe drugs in the entire system. And that can happen with what we talked about earlier with the vertical integration that occurs when perhaps some of the companies that own the PBMs or some of the pharmaceutical distribution mechanisms are also owned by the companies that are recommending this care. And so we can see perhaps a conflict of interest that can arise where the incentive to make money is not always necessarily tied towards the incentive to keeping the patient healthy. And this is one of the core things that we are just struggling to correct at a systems level. But it comes out with this very real experience of a patient of being perhaps in your 7-minute visit with your doctor, given a prescription for a medication instead of a longer root analysis to find out what could be done to get at that root cause through non-medical or non-pharmaceutical intervention.
But still, there are people who are very fit, who do follow these exercise and diet regimes, and they still have high cholesterol, they still have high blood pressure, and so they're still going to have some medical interventions in order to
Absolutely.
Address those things. It's not just not blame the people for it all the time, you know?
Absolutely. This is not to say that pharmaceutical intervention is never appropriate at all. This is to say that there are appropriate realms for us to live healthier lives, and there is also the appropriate range for making sure that when we are seeking that medical care, that it is available and that it is affordable for people so that they can access it when they need it.
A lot of times people go, you know, you end up in the hospital and you get your medical bill. How much information is in that medical bill? Is it going to be appropriately itemized?
That's a great question, and something that has recently changed in Texas law. In the past, what would frequently happen is you would go to a hospital, and sometime after you were discharged, you would get a bill, and it would just say, for example, you know, you owe us $5,000, please pay within 30 days. And you wouldn't really know what exactly that was for, how it broke down, what the services were. The prior law was that you could call in and request an itemized bill, but if some of your listeners or I or you have ever tried to do that, that was very difficult to do. The call centers were only very rarely open after working hours. Sometimes it would take quite a time to get somebody who would be able to do that to you, and there were other barriers in the way. But Texas recently passed a law that requires hospitals to present you with an itemized bill either at the same time as they are asking for money or prior to that time. So if you ever get a request from a hospital for money, they are required to provide you with that itemized bill. And one of the things that's
really
helpful.
And then what do you do with it?
So if you look down the list of what has been itemized, now you can see what is being charged for what. Now sometimes, and I've had this experience myself, there are services listed on there that actually were not provided. It will say, oh, you received a certain number of pills or drugs, or you saw this particular provider. And perhaps that's what happens on a standard case, but it was not what happened in our case. And so we were able to say, no, those services didn't happen. You need to take those off the bill. In other cases, what you can do when you see what is actually being charged for something is it gives you a stronger basis to say that's unreasonable. In some cases, you will look at the bill and see that they are charging, say, $20 for a Tylenol pill, or they are charging $5 for water. Whatever the case may be, with that information, once you have the itemized nature of that bill, it puts you in a better position to be able to, A, ensure the accuracy of the services that were provided, and then B, challenge the reasonableness of the prices that are being asserted. And once you have that information, that empowers you as a patient to protect yourself and maybe reduce the amount of medical debt that you could go into.
So the idea is that I should shop around for my health care, and that would create a healthy market. But, you know, being informed, being engaged in competition, you know, that's very difficult to do. You know, I'm sick. I need a doctor. It's not like shopping for a car. I could just, you know, I could spend months doing research.
So when we talk about what creates the healthy market in healthcare, it's interesting because while we as patients are in some sense consumers and payers, A lot of times the real payers are our employers. So over half of Texans receive their insurance coverage through their employer. And the employer is the one who is the primary payer for these services. And they are also the ones that have pre-negotiated contracts with a wide range of providers to make sure that there are those prices there. And when you receive your insurance through your employer, that employer has a fiduciary duty to you to make sure that they are providing you with the best overall plan. So part of what we are working for when we talk about making sure that there is transparency and choice is not just to put that burden on us as patients. There is a little bit of that, and I'll get into that. But it's also to empower these institutional purchasers of healthcare, which is how over half of us, that's the channel that we get this healthcare.
And so I'm just going to lean into what my plan allows me to get.
Yes. And so especially when we're talking about through the employer needs to be empowered to be able to give you signals, right? So as you say, you get sick, you don't need to spend months doing the kind of comparison shopping that you might do when you're going out and looking for a car. You want to be able to hop on and get good recommendations quickly to be able to do this. And so if you trust your employer, you should hopefully be able to hop on your employer's insurance plan and have signals on that plan. You say, I am sick, I need to see a doctor, and you should be able to get a list of, here are doctors near you that we have pre-vetted for quality and price, and we think that these are gonna be good options for you. So that has already done a lot of the work for you, and now you get that information readily available to you.
Well, now, but if you don't have insurance,
if you don't have insurance, it is much more difficult to be able to do that. That is absolutely true.
And so when you show up at the ER and tell them you have a collapsed lung, you know, what do you do?
If you're in that situation, it's going to be very difficult for you. Uninsured individuals who are showing up at the emergency room are really at the mercy of the medical system at that point. You are in a medical emergency and you lack that insurance. What we would say is the best thing is to, again, go check out in advance. Being insured is a very helpful tool to make sure that you are protected in emergencies like these. And that is why we continue to emphasize to people, go check and see what you are available for. And I wanna be really push this. We talked earlier that about 2 million people in Texas, when we did our study, were eligible for a free plan and not enrolled. At the time, that was 40% of the uninsured population. So really and truly.
Get on that. Yeah, check it out. Okay, I got to hit this break. And yeah. Jennifer, I'm going to get you on the air when we come back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. With me on the line, Charles Miller, Health Policy Director for Texas 2036, a nonpartisan public policy think tank in Austin. You can call in with your questions and comments. How are you dealing with the rising cost of healthcare and pharmaceuticals? 833-877-8255. Let's go to Jennifer on the phones. And Jennifer, thanks for calling in.
Hey, I've noticed in the last 5 years that it used to be that the big health insurance and insurers would steer you away from certain emergency facilities. And, you know, it got to be where you could only use just a handful of these emergency clinics. And then in the last year or so, for instance, Cigna has let the contract with Baptist Health System expire. So, yes, there seems to be more and more collusion between large insurers and hospital systems. So that's my comment.
Well, Jennifer, thank you for that. So people sometimes call these places doc in a box. Charles, you know, how does that fit into this?
So this gets into the really fun, exciting, and complicated world of network contracting.
Oh, boy.
all right. So There's two parts to this story, and one of them is the patient access side. And we hear about network adequacy requirements. And so the way to think about a network is if you have an insurance plan, if you've got a PPO plan, a lot of times your insurance will have a network. And so if you go to a provider that is within that network, you get a better deal. If you go to a provider that is outside of that network, that deal is worse for you. And there are, again, two sides to this. So insurers have been creating tighter networks because that helps increase affordability. But it can also have the negative side of decreasing access. And so as with everything, there are trade-offs involved here. If you want the broadest network and the most access, that is going to end up being more expensive. If you want the lowest price, you're going to have a reduced network access. And so that's kind of at the heart of a lot of these debates where you will see a system go out of network. It's the same thing, honestly, that we see sometimes with these cable, TV cable contracts. And recently, ESPN and YouTube TV, I don't know if many of your listeners were following that. I, as a sports fan, was affected by that. But it's the same sort of thing, is that the service delivery bundler, you know, YouTube TV or your health insurer in this case, they are trying to make sure that they are keeping prices lower. And sometimes the content provider or medical service provider wants to increase those prices. And that's where we see those conflicts occur. This is not uncommon. It has difficult effects on consumers, but it is part of the overall contract negotiation price to try to end up at an appropriate equilibrium. What I would say is that this entire process has gotten much, much more difficult as we have seen more and more consolidation in the market, as there are fewer and fewer functional choices for service providers. That has given them more leverage within a given market to charge higher prices. And this is part of the story of why healthcare has gotten more expensive. And so from a patient perspective, we look at this and we're caught in a rock and a hard place, right? We don't want to have our service interrupted because the provider that we go to, the doctor that we go to, the hospital that we like is now suddenly out of network. But if all we want is to make sure that everyone is always within this broad network, we will never have any chance of bringing down the price because there's no functional leverage to bring that down. And so this is the constant back and forth that we see within network contracting disputes, and is part of why we work so hard to both protect what existing competition we have and encourage more competition so that there are more choices. And any given particular contract dispute that might occur disrupts fewer people because they have a smaller chunk of the market. And we don't see these huge major disruptions that could occur.
So let's talk about outcomes. I mean, I look around, I go to the Walmart and I see a lot of people that they don't look healthy. A lot of people, they really look like they're infirmed. And it makes me wonder, are people not benefiting from this wonderful healthcare system that we have because they can't afford it? And we have people, they may be, you know, the lifespan is not as long as it used to be, and people are really hurting.
So one of the things that we look at when we, to bring this international comparison back, is that in the U.S., we spend far, far, far more per capita than any other country on healthcare. And our outcomes are in many cases worse. When we look at life expectancy, when we look at obesity, when we look at functional health ability, it's lower. And we might say, well, how are we getting such bad outcomes when we're spending that much? And the flip side of that might be that the high prices themselves could be, as you point out, a barrier to being able to access.
Or I'm going to spend, look, the entirety that I'm going to have in my lifetime that I'm going to spend on healthcare, probably 80, 85% of that is going to be in the last 3 years of my life.
That's probably accurate, which is a statistical quirk of the most expensive healthcare encounter that you'll generally have is going to be the one that leads to the end. That is generally how that works, yeah.
So, but if we did spend more on the front end, then possibly it would be better off on the back end and not so expensive.
So that's right. A lot of other countries have emphasized and encouraged primary and preventive care. And the payment rates in this country are such that that is really de-emphasized. If you are a physician and you're graduating medical school and you look at what your salary, what your reimbursements might be for as a general family practitioner versus being a specialist, they are disparate. And you can make a lot more money as a doctor being that specialist. So the way that we pay for healthcare in this country is incentivizing less preventive care on the front end, less of that treatment, early detection, maintenance, staying healthy, doing the right healthy activities, and much more about paying for the acute level services on the back end. And that has the effect of making things more expensive, and it also leads to some of these worse outcomes. And this is true both in our publicly funded systems and how we pay for care, but it's also true within the private insurance
but
system.
But in the Affordable Care Act, there were supposed to be provisions to make having preventative care free or low cost, and that's not happening.
So if you have insurance that is regulated by the Affordable Care Act, there is a list of preventative services that is covered at no cost to you. And that was designed to encourage you to go get, say, a yearly checkup at your doctor
or
to get your vaccinations or to get these sorts of, mammograms, colonoscopies, these sorts of screenings that are designed to capture these things early.
But then lo and behold, you still get billed for it.
So this is one of the big problems that we are starting to see emerge with a phenomenon that's known a little bit as facility fees. And so facility fees are what happens when you go to seek a service at, say, a doctor's clinic that has been bought up or purchased through this vertical integration by a hospital system. And the hospital system now will add on another bill to this service that is called the facility fee that is designed to, they own the clinic, they're charging for their overhead, and the doctor will give their bill for the service that they provided. And you as a, those bills will go to your insurance company. And from the insurer's perspective, they have to now code all of these preventative services and make sure that you, the patient, are protected. From the doctor's bill, they're able to do that. They see that the doctor provided this service at an outpatient clinic, and it was for this service and it was preventative. Great, we have that coded as preventative. You as the patient are protected. But when the hospital portion comes in sometimes, it looks to the insurer on the claim form, and this is a little wonky, but it's important, is it looks like it's coming from the hospital's main campus and not from that doctor's office that is owned by the hospital. And so it's hard for the insurer to link these claims up and see, oh, that hospital facility fee bill is for a preventive service. And so as the patient, you go in for this service and you think that you're getting something preventative, and so it should be covered at no cost to you, and then you get a bill from the hospital.
Yeah, this is the problem.
It's a real problem. And we've been working at this at the legislature for the last couple of sessions. We got pretty far with a proposal last time around, but the solutions end up, as so often happens in healthcare, being really, really hyper-technical. And in this one, it was about what type of provider identification number needs to be on the claim form. And so it's not a clean, clear solution to the problem that will provide the best outcome, but it is about increasing transparency. And the way that we would describe the solution here is that if your insurer can know where the service was actually provided, which is not clear on the claim form right now, then that will help them make sure that they're able to protect you, the patient, according to the provisions of the Affordable Care Act.
Wrapping up here, I want to hit this point again that we have an uninsured population that are eligible for ACA subsidies, Medicaid, or CHIP. nearly 3 million of these states' folks, they could get free health care, free health insurance. They just need to know that that's available to them and go get it. Thank you so much, Charles Miller, for talking about that, Health Policy Director for Texas 2036.
And one last point, open enrollment ends January 15th. So if you want to sign up, you have 1 week to do so.
Awesome. Thank you so much. That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.